Welcome to the Faith Element Podcast for the October 29, 2017 session, focusing on Leviticus chapter 19, verses 1 and 2, and 15 through 18. Choose holiness. I'm David Cassidy.
I'm Nikki Hardiman.
I'm Seth Oppenheimer.
And I'm Burt Montgomery.
Our friend Daniel is away for this episode, but we are excited to have our favorite rabbi back with us, Seth Oppenheimer.
Yay!
Happy to be here. We're such a serious group.
Yes, isn't that true? Well, in case you've not heard Seth before, and if you've listened to the podcast for some time, you've already been introduced to Seth, but I'll give you just a little bit of background on him. Besides being a close friend of Bert's, and we'll try not to hold that against you, Seth.
Seth there is aren't a person... that many people who will put up with me, and Bert's a very tolerant fellow.
Well, he does that for us as well. So, Seth has many talents. Over the years, he's taught and played administrative roles relating to mathematics, religion, philosophy at Mississippi State. He also serves as the Director of Undergraduate Research for the Shackles Honors College of Mississippi State. And since 2007, he served the B'nai Israel congregation in Columbus, Mississippi. And Seth, we're really glad you're back with us.
Always a pleasure.
So we're in Leviticus, which explains why the good rabbi is with us. And
indeed,
it's a book that, you know, not a lot of folks would probably say, hey, that's my favorite book of scripture to study. But it's actually really quite interesting. I think so. So Bert, might you help us get started with our conversation tonight?
Yeah, I'll try. You know, I have to confess, it is pretty intimidating to be asked to give some background info on a text from the Torah, from Leviticus, from one of the books of Moses, with Rabbi Seth sitting here. So, Seth, I'm not going to try to give any profound opening statements here, because I'm going to look forward to your insights and input as we discuss this passage.
Thank you for the lack of
sure. well, you know, the tradition in which I grew up, the Protestant tradition, the very Baptist tradition, there was so much emphasis on the Old Testament versus the New Testament, as if, you know, the Old Testament is this old thing. We don't need it anymore. Here's the New Testament. This is all updated. There's a different, you know, and people throughout our church history have talked about there's two different gods, the God of the Old Testament, the God of the New Testament. And there have been movements early in church history to take the Hebrew scriptures out of the Christian Bible. So as we're reading this text from Leviticus this morning, it's really interesting because we're reading Jewish theology, and we're reading all this stuff, and you have to ask, where did Jesus get all the stuff he talked about? Well, it's not like he pulled it out of thin air or he was making up new things on the spot. He was pulling and drawing upon the rich Jewish tradition, much of which comes from Leviticus and the Holiness Code and the books of Moses. The text we're reading about today reminds us that in Jewish tradition, and I think this is what Jesus says a lot as well, is, you know, approaching God and being holy is not simply about withdrawing into yourself, into prayer, into meditation, fasting, things like this, although that is part of it, but is also very outward, and it's very outward with moral implications in our relationship to others. Being holy, Leviticus says, as God is holy, is clearly tied to how we treat others. You know, in more current Christian lingo, some scholars, are instead of saying Old Testament and New Testament, are talking about the First Testament and the Second Testament, as though the two still go together and one does not overwrite the other. Mm-hmm. And I think this is very important. As we hear this text today, you know, the Lord said to Moses, be holy because I, the Lord your God, am holy. And then there are things like this, verses 15 through 18. Be honest, be just when you make decisions in legal cases. Do not show favoritism to the poor or fear the rich. Don't spread lies. Mm-hmm. Don't bear grudges. Settle your differences. Do not take revenge on anyone. Love your neighbor as you love yourself. again, Jesus didn't just pull all this stuff out of thin air. He was pulling it from his rich tradition. And so as we talk about this, we need to be reminded that holiness is not something we do, we earn, or we do and achieve on our own. If we are to be holy as God is, holy, and we are created in the image of God, then we do unto others as we would have them do unto us, and we treat others as God and God's grace and God's love for all God's children treats others. Love our neighbors as ourselves. And as Jesus points out, and this again is nothing new, elsewhere in Leviticus, we don't get to define who our neighbors is, who our neighbors are. I'm going to stop there. I'm rambling. I'm going to stop there because I'm going to sit back. I'm going to listen to the scholar here. Rabbi Seth, the show's yours.
Well, I'll just say that specifically, if you go to verse 34 of the same chapter, it says, "The strangers who reside with you shall be to you as your citizens. You shall love each one as yourself." Mm-hmm. So, and that's said a lot of times.
So this concept of holiness, how do we wrap our heads around what is probably a very different sense of, quote, holiness than we may automatically presume with our modern sensibilities? How?
Well, holiness is dangerous, right? It's power. Mm. It's to get close to the Holy One, as Aaron's elder sons discovered, can lead to death. Or the chap whose name escapes me who tried to write the Ark of the Covenant when it was falling off the wagon being transported.
Right.
Yeah. And these are not people who did wrong things in a moral sense or an ethical sense, but there was a misstep within a very dangerous realm. A lot of the cases where you see people have to be purified before re-entering holy spaces involves being in the liminal space between life and death. There's blood. There's things that are not clean in a ritual sense, where there's an unclarity, where there's a crossing over in some sense, a twilight sense. And you don't want to be in that place when you're approaching something dangerous. I mean, kadosh, holiness is from a root to mean separate. And one of the places I have a disagreement with Karen Armstrong is she says that that's in some sense a despairing cry, that the holy is so separate and apart. But we partake of that also. So it's not completely separate, but it's a powerful and dangerous state. But as I think the texts that we chose to read today show, and this is one of my favorite taglines, is that a theology that does not imply an ethics and does not imply an action is bad theology. Mm. And this whole thing of holiness, we see, as we read in the later text, implies action, implies acting for God. My folks get tired of me saying this, but, you know, the king is not the one who sweeps the floor. The king is not the one who waters the plants. The king is not the one who makes the bed, prepares the food, makes sure that the fire is set. The king's servants do that. And in trying to be servants of the Holy One of Blessing, using the image of the king, there is no human king to go to. The implication is that we have to carry out that work as good servants. So there's always an implication in attempting to reach for holiness, is what is the ethical implication of that?
This is fascinating. Again, I'm going to draw a lot from my own background growing up and things I've heard and emphasis that I don't necessarily always agree with now, but things that were stressed. The idea of being holy was about me right thinking, moral purity, more so than, and what I don't do, more so than how I do treat the community and others. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's the Greek tradition within Christianity.
Yeah.
The Jewish tradition is more on the orthopraxis rather than the orthodoxy.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
So, and both strains live within Christianity.
Sure.
And I think you see this in the social justice gospel is pushing more acting in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then the tradition that you're talking about is more about that internal state and that moral state.
Yeah.
The Jewish tradition much more leans towards right action. And it's a sin to embarrass somebody. So one interpretation where it says in our text, reprove your kin, but incur no guilt on their account. One of the standard rabbinic interpretations of that is that you privately reprove someone. You don't publicly humiliate them.
Right.
And that if you publicly humiliate them, then you incur guilt because you've embarrassed somebody.
I think this is an important conversation for the people who would be listening to this. And I'm assuming that it's primarily Christian, maybe teachers or preachers or maybe just people who enjoy the conversation. I think that in the Christian tradition, when we talk, and I think this is what we're all talking around, but I'd really like to try to flesh it out some more because I think that it feels really complicated. So I think that within the Christian tradition, we equate holiness with morality. Mm. To be holy is to be a moral person. And I don't know that we would articulate it that way, but I think that's the way that it gets taught in Christian in our Christian churches. I think it's kind of this way we've come to understand it. But within the Levitical tradition and the way that it's used here in this text, that's not exactly what it means. And you've talked some about it, but I was wondering if you'd be able to talk a little bit about what holiness means kind of in the context of a world that equates holiness with morality and help see some of the nuance and difference about that.
It's very difficult for me to lay out a formal definition of holiness. I think it's one of those words like love that is very difficult to formally define.
Right.
I think in both the Jewish tradition and the Christian tradition, though, people who are deeply flawed can be holy.
Okay.
We see that in the stories that we share.
Sure.
We see that with, you can hardly think of someone more flawed than David.
Indeed, right? Indeed. Yes.
Yet he recognized that he was a shepherd of someone else's flock.
Right.
And was working in the world of real politic, but still managed that. And looking at Abraham and Sarah and Hagar and the conflicts and
right.
The jealousies and
Jacob
tricking his father with the connivance of his mother who encouraged him.
Right. All of these were holy people.
Who God addressed directly, right? Remember Rivka.
Right.
Rebecca spoke directly with God, right?
Yes.
And yet there is holiness in these people.
Yes.
So it's not about being perfect, certainly not being morally perfect. I can't see that. But I think that it has to do with the connection to that deeper reality and the recognition of kinship with our fellow human beings, as well as the broader world, that we all have that image of God, that B'Tselem Elohim, that is stamped within us or on us or however we want to interpret that. That's our connection with holiness. But I don't know how to, I mean, I write poetry about this stuff because I don't know how to say it other than metaphor.
Right. Sure. And I don't know that you can get at it in any way other than metaphor. I guess what I want is for our listeners to begin to think about this concept of holiness as something much more complex than simple making the moral choice. You talked about how when we allow ourselves to enter into the realm of the holy, it is dangerous. It is unpredictable. We are quite literally taking our life into our own hands, at least as we read it in these stories.
One of the Hasidic masters taught that you have to get so deep into your prayer that there's a danger that you die in your prayer. Mm. Now, that's the personal aspect, right? That inner connection aspect. But holiness is how we act in the world, mm-hmm. also, very strongly within the Jewish tradition. Mm-hmm. I've mentioned Rabbi Harold Schulweis before in terms of actualizing the predicates of holiness and imitatio Dio, if I pronounce that correctly, imitating God, doing what God would have us do. And that is the way we bring holiness into the world, I think. You know, I gave my Yom Kippur morning sermon on some of the writings of Abraham Joshua Heschel. There always seemed to be an implication of something you had to do when you had that experiential of wonder,
right,
of connection with the holy. And the image I had in my mind is holiness is not being a fire burning alone in the wilderness. Yes, you may be experiencing a mystical connection with God, but what good does that do? You're good. Mm. You can see your own light. You can feel your own heat.
Uh-huh.
But if you don't harness that to do good in the world,
mm-hmm.
what have you done? If you don't use that light to illumine things for other people, or that warmth to warm the cold, or to fill the bag of the balloon so that people can fly, it seems selfish.
So is it fair to say that holiness is a way of being in the world, a way of existing?
Part of it. I don't have a definition. This is a problem. But I think that there are lots of aspects of holiness. It's something that's always available that we usually don't connect to, that we try.
I like that. I like that phrase. It's something that's always available. And that made me think of, when I read Leviticus, when I look at Torah, I always get this impression that the Torah is, it talks about all of the everyday things, things that we do every day, and it instructs us on how to behave, that how we eat, how we interact with different kinds of people that we come in touch with every day, how we care for our families. And so the act of choosing what we put in our bodies is an act of choosing or not choosing holiness. The act of how we relate to the person behind the grocery counter, or the person who hands our prescriptions to us out the door, or the person who is begging on the street, the way that we relate to them is to choose holiness or to not choose holiness. Is this...
Well, this is Buber, right?
Mm.
Are you dealing with an it, or are you dealing with a thou?
Right.
I and thou.
Heschel wrote, God is in the details of things, right?
Right.
It's, God is concerned with detail,
mm-hmm.
in the specifics of how we treat other people and how we live our lives. He wrote, it's very easy to love humanity in general.
Mm. Sure.
It's very hard to love the person standing,
right,
in front of you.
Right.
That's a paraphrase, but that's basically.
It's a good word.
Wow. And, you know, Jimmy Carter used to say as a child, he was taught by, I guess, a Sunday school teacher or something, your job is first to love God, and then second, to love the person standing right in front of you.
That's the easiest access to God, is another human being.
Yeah, exactly.
No matter who that is. So, and it's for me, because maybe, you know, there's a word of hope in that even when I have moments when I choose the wrong path toward holiness, there will be another moment to make a better choice, and another moment to make a better choice, and another moment to choose holiness, because those moments are available to us all the time. And I love that. I love that, what you said.
We keep trying. That's what makes us human, is the ability to choose.
Seth, you said something a while back, and I there's not much to discuss here. I just want to point something out. You mentioned why it's hard to to pinpoint this, and you write poetry, because this is all you could do is just kind of express metaphor and point to images that it's sort of like this. And very interestingly, you know, that's basically what Jesus did, right? Mm. Most of the time they tried to push him on things, and he always came back with metaphors, with stories, with images.
Parable.
Rather than specific A, B, C, D, you know, breaking it down.
Mm-hmm.
Stories are a great way to teach.
So Leviticus. Mm-hmm. So we have these verses here. You shall not, you shall not. It's giving us what feels like law, but is it really better to interpret it as hints at how to live in a way that helps us be more holy?
Yeah, good. Okay, good question for the rabbi, because when we think of law, we think there's a...
These are always questions for me, thanks.
Yeah. But, well, back when we were first started gathering at the tavern, and there was a small enough group we could have conversations, it got bigger, so now we have smaller conversations instead of one big conversation. But we used to play Stump the Rabbi. But anyway...
questions for the rabbi.
Yes, when we think of law, our mindset is so clearly, if there's a law, then there's a punishment. If you break the law, there's a punishment. But you're saying that this is more of a path toward something, more so than a just don't touch that, you're going to get your hand smacked if you do.
I think the Leviticus has several different sorts of layers. There is a layer of how do you purify the schmutz, the dirt that has accumulated by communal and individual sin. Sacrifice is not about, I'm going to sacrifice so I'll be forgiven. The repentance occurs before the sacrifice. It's a marker and a way to try to rectify the spiritual accretions that might have occurred because of sin. Mm. There's also here general ideas. Love your neighbor as yourself is not statutory law. It's more along the lines of the 10 words, which are kind of very general. And then there are specific things. You'll use fair weights with an implication, then there will be punishment if you don't, because that's a very specific, concrete thing. And so I think there are multiple structures. And, you know, I look at this, I mean, just reading 15, you shall not render an unfair decision, do not favor the poor, or should show deference to the rich. Mm. Judge your kin fairly. The implication here,
sure,
is that there are two tendencies, that you have sympathy for the poor, which you have to be warned against, which is a very comforting thing to find in the text if you think about it. And there are those who want to show deference to those who are wealthy and important. And you have to guard against both. And it's saying on how you are doing that as a judge, but the implication is in your daily life, don't be so quick to judge the other based on your perception of their position.
Mm.
So there's this general way of living your life and walking through your life and dealing with other people. And I think David's absolutely right on that.
Do we have a poem that would be appropriate?
Do you really want me to read one of my poems?
I don't know.
I do. I love your poetry.
I do want to point one thing out before, if you're going to have me read a poem, is the line here, Lo ta'mod al dam re'echa, don't stand on the blood of your fellow. And the traditional Jewish interpretation of that is that if someone is suffering, you shall not stand idly by the blood of your neighbor, that you're not allowed to be passive in the case of suffering or injustice. You must act rather than standing idly by.
Mm.
Mm.
So that's a rabbinic interpretation. It's not clear from, it says don't stand in the blood of your, it could be, you could say, oh, if my neighbor's bleeding, I shouldn't stand in his blood. I mean,
sure.
But that's not how it's usually interpreted. And again, right, that speaks to the idea that David spoke of in terms of it, the text, at least in part, Leviticus leading us on to the way we need to live our lives.
So not to put you on the spot, but do you have an appropriate poem for the...
I can give you a choice. Well, I'll tell you what. I just actually emailed all of you this poem, so I might as well open this up.
He's already selected one.
Well, there are two that make sense for this. One is the one I'm going to read, and the other one is on sacrifice as a place marker. I mean, the Jewish tradition is that how do you know you're forgiven from sin? It's when you don't commit the sin anymore. That when you've really turned away, tshuva, to repent is just to turn, like adjusting an aim for an archer. I actually wrote this poem in response because of Nadab and Abihu and Uzzah. So Uzzah was the guy who tried to catch the ark when it was sliding off the wagon and died.
Yes.
So I had written a rather condemnatory poem, which I note in the preface to this, a reflection on the portion of Shemini, which is a portion where Nadab and Abihu die, burned up in fire. A toddler may climb up a chair, attempt to perch on it. She may fall, a bruise, a scrape, some tears, a lesson learned. More care, perhaps, will be taken in future adventures. A schoolboy climbs a tree. Now the height is greater. If the branch is too weak, the grip insecure, a step careless, a broken arm, a shattered knee, a concussion. The climber approaches the top of the spire, a finger of stone pointing to heaven, a crevice misjudged, a stone seeming secure slips, a momentary loss of concentration, a long fall. Time to consider choices, errors, a life passing, death. A dream of flight, a simple thing, but to scream skyward in a silver shell, propelled, rising on a pillar of fire, one mistake. The pilot, her hands slick upon the yoke, the engineer in a minor computation, the worker who tightened the 613th bolt on the secondary assembly, glory turns to catastrophe, brilliance to ash, exaltation to death. It is not fair. It is not just, but it is. To climb so high requires care. One slip, one moment, moment of inattention, destruction. But oh, to ascend upon the chariot, to pass through the gates of the seven celestial palaces, perhaps to return, perhaps dead, mad, to grasp even a 60th of a 60th of a 60th of a partial understanding, glimpse of the holy? But four entered the orchard, one died, one went mad, one cut the roots of who he was, turned away from himself. One, only one, entered in peace and left in peace. Uzzah, so honored to escort the ark, only wanted to serve, only wanted to help. But touch, one touch, and death. The sons of Aaron brought a new thing, born of a passion to serve, to be close, a strange fire, something to please the Holy One in the holy place, by fire, as was that which was brought close, they were consumed. To soar, to join with, to hut, to touch, to hope, to touch, the holy, to walk among the stars can be to balance, balance on a flaming blade, terror and trembling, take care, but how can I refuse the flight?
Maybe that's why Paul says we should work out our faith with fear and trembling.
Mm-hmm.
Quite likely. Well, thank you all for a fascinating conversation tonight. Wow, we've got to do Leviticus again sometime. This was good. Thank you, Seth, for joining us and helping us work through this.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Good night, y'all.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Faith Element is a service of Faith Lab.